Why is everyone getting so worked up over taxes? Billionaires barely pay them. That comes with their access. Private equity likes to hide them. That's how they run their game. The rich stay richer. It's all the same. CEO pay keeps climbing. Is this really fair? The gap keeps growing. You can't even compare. Maybe that's why the ultra-rich want to go to outer space. They made their fortune. Time to get out of this place. Bezos and Branson, Elon Musk too, sitting in their capsules with R2-D2. But now lawmakers want to tighten the screws, claw back those riches, make it headline news. We've seen this before in every generation. Income inequality, the scourge of the nation. We can get mad, let this make us depressed, or we can keep learning aboard the Investopedia Express. Well, welcome to the working week, as Elvis Costello likes to say. The U.S. stock market kicks off the week coming off of record highs for the S&P 500. Last week, the benchmark index hit its 28th and 29th all-time record high closes for the year. They come in clusters. Are you ready for some big numbers? The Labor Department reported that the Consumer Price Index rose 5% in May from a year earlier. That's the biggest one-month jump since right before the 2008 financial crisis. The so-called core rate, which excludes those volatile food and energy prices, that was up 3.5%, the most since May of 1992. That was a big number, but so was the U.S. budget deficit, which topped $2 trillion for the first time last month. U.S. government debt for the month was just below $132 billion. Federal government debt now stands at $28.2 trillion. That costs U.S. taxpayers $319.9 billion in interest expenses just this fiscal year. This is after paying $522.8 billion in 2020. Now you see why the Biden administration wants higher taxes? On the flip side, U.S. household net worth reached a new high in the first quarter of 2021. The total balance sheet for households and nonprofit institutions climbed to $136.9 trillion in the first quarter. That was a 3.8% jump from the fourth quarter of 2020. This is all according to the Federal Reserve's quarterly report on household debt and credit. Hey, for all you econ wonks out there, if you ever really want to geek out on economic reports and deep data dives into how we spend and invest, check out that report. It's pretty intense. We can thank the stock market for a lot of that growth, as $3.2 trillion of it came from equity holdings, while $1 trillion came from the appreciation of real estate prices. On the other side of the ledger, household debt totaled $16.9 trillion for the quarter. That's growing at 6.5%. The fastest pace going back to 2006. Easy money is making people borrow a lot more than they used to. Property information provider CoreLogic reported that in the first quarter, the equity in homes with a mortgage jumped 19.6% from a year ago to a total of $1.9 trillion. That works out to an average gain of $33,400 per borrower, the most in at least a decade. CoreLogic also noted that only 2.6% of homeowners were underwater or owing more than their house is worth. That's the lowest level since they began tracking information as of 2009, and that's a very good thing. The spotlight is shining on big tech again. Amazon, Apple, Facebook, and Google could be forced to overhaul their business practices under a new expansive set of antitrust reforms introduced by the bipartisan House Judiciary Committee last week. A package of five bills would make it harder for these mega platforms to complete mergers, and they would prohibit them from owning businesses that present clear conflicts of interest. It's a little late for that, but maybe this is the beginning of the unwinding. These bills have a long, long way to go. They need to be voted on by the full House Judiciary Committee before making their way to the full House of Representatives. Then they need to be approved by the Senate before they could be signed into law by the president. But don't think that these mega tech companies aren't lawyering and lobbying up for this fight. The IPO market is heating up again. Last week, Didi Chuxing, China's largest ride-hailing service, filed for a U.S. IPO at a reported $70 billion valuation. Didi reported 2020 revenue of $21.6 billion. That's more than Lyft and Uber combined. U.S.-listed IPOs could raise up to $40 billion from June through August of this year, topping last year's record of $32 billion. Remember Oatly, the maker of the world's best coffee ice cream? It went public in May and set the stage for a hot IPO market. It's currently trading 50% higher than its IPO price. Robinhood, the stock trading platform, is also preparing for a highly anticipated IPO at a potential valuation of $40 billion. And Krispy Kreme is making its return to the public markets, having filed for an IPO back in May. Look for that ticker symbol, DNUT, and if you haven't had a Krispy Kreme hot off the sugar shower in one of its stores, get involved, people. You're welcome. Let's get ready for the week ahead. After topping record highs for the S&P 500 last week and more madness among meme stocks, investors can look forward to a relatively quiet corporate calendar this week, but also a very busy economic calendar, highlighted by the Federal Reserve's meeting on interest rates this Tuesday and Wednesday. European equity markets have the momentum at the moment as industrial and manufacturing economies like Germany, the UK, and France are finally starting to roll. We'll get reports on industrial production, manufacturing, and labor costs from several European countries and the US this week. The US, Germany, and the UK will all release final numbers for May. We know input costs are rising for almost all raw materials and fuel, which is part of what's driving consumer prices higher. China just reported the fastest rise in producer prices in 13 years, so we should not be surprised to see similar spikes across Europe and the United States. And what's the Fed thinking? The FOMC meets this Tuesday and Wednesday on interest rate policy, and the drumbeat is getting louder for the central bank to slow down its roll of its purchase of $120 billion in monthly government bonds. We know a rate hike is out of the question for now, but if there are hints that the Fed is even thinking about raising rates, that could create some waves across capital markets. It will also be the first time we hear the Fed's take on the latest CPI report from May, which delivered the highest year-over-year increase in consumer prices in 13 years. Fed Chair Jerome Powell and other Fed governors have been calling this bout of inflation, quote, transitory and expected, given pent-up demand. U.S. household balance sheets are in pretty good shape, and the consumer's holding up so far. The question is, how long will that last if transitory turns into a long-term trend? The 1970s and 80s produced a wave of legendary investors who became widely followed and listened to for their wisdom and their ability to see around corners. Mario Gabelli is one of them, and he's still at the top of his game today. He's the founder, chairman, and chief executive of GAMCO Investors. He's a giant in the world of philanthropy with the Gabelli School of Business at Fordham University named for him, and he's also a summa cum laude graduate of that school, and he is our very special guest on the Investopedia Express this week. Bronx's finest. Welcome, Mr. Gabelli. Thank you for being here.
Caleb, delighted, privileged to do this. Thank you.
I've been following your career since I started mine, and you are such an astute observer and participant of the markets. What surprises you most about the stock market today and this ride we've been on since the pandemic began and we emerged out of it?
We thought that it was going to be an isolated pandemic, but then it emerged in South Korea, it emerged in Italy, and it became worldwide. And at that point in time, probably in March of 2020, and you had a complete shutdown of systems like March Madness, which is a basketball tournament, was canceled and so on. And at that time, gold and govies were hot stocks. And as soon as we got into the beginning of April, the growth stocks took off, particularly those that were part of what I call the digital revolution. Go back 100 years ago, you had the industrial revolution. Today, you had the emerging digital revolution, which started to take place. And so remote learning, remote work, remote ordering kind of became the dynamic of the day. Fast forward, as we got past through July, August, September, then the market started looking forward to a cyclical recovery. And the banks, oil, travel, and leisure that were particularly pummeled, Caleb, started turning around. And that has what continued in the first half of so far this year. In addition to that, you then saw individuals that were at home playing with Fortnite and learned how to play those games, all of a sudden started buying shares and became part of, Wall Street Bet, social media, Reddit, and obviously the company Robinhood that offered free commissions without any guardrails. And that obviously created some challenges. So those were some of the dynamics. Those mechanics were particularly unfolded in the month of January when you had stocks that were shorted, kind of whatever, exploded. Then we moved in and had some other mechanical problems where some very sophisticated investment organizations, which Credit Suisse and so on, or financed Caicos and created some challenges there. So the mechanics of the market already started back about 2015-16. You started getting algos, momos, and other quantitatively oriented portfolios also functioning in the market. So you have to reverse engineer how do they function, what do they do, and how do they handle daily fluctuations. And so you have to look at what we do is step back and take a microscope on stocks, looking at the 10Ks, the annuals data that is provided by trade magazines and so on, and take our accumulated and compounded knowledge of certain industries and try to develop what are these companies worth. So you take certain cyclicals, how bad is bad, how good is good, how long will it take to get good? And if it's good, what gives them a higher valuation than they would normally trade at? So some of those are the dots. And then the next problem was, when we onboard new names, we really like to visit them. And so the Zoom market, and even though we've had plenty of conferences since then, and you keep in touch, it's not the same as the intensity. So, for example, this week on, I guess it was Tuesday or Wednesday, we went up to visit a company. We were the first outside investors that were welcome to the corporate offices. I had seen three in Florida. I was the first one to see those companies. And we're going to do a lot more of that.
The dynamics of the market, you explained a lot of what went on. Did any of it shock you? Because we've been through some cycles like this where day traders really, you know, get very involved in the market. But this seemed different. So many new retail traders, so much easier to trade. Technology has obviously made it free. Brokers have made free trading available. It doesn't take much to get online. Did any of that shock you a little bit?
No, because, you know, you go back and the delusions of grandeur, the madness of crowds was written in 1854, where you had the tulip, you had the canals, you had the railroads, probably not the railroads at that time. And you had a variety of manias, the South Sea China bubble. So you always get these dynamics. The only thing that was particularly different was the Federal Reserve. Powell came out and basically put the foot on the accelerator and has kept it there with regards to pumping money in. And then that was accompanied by a fairly massive fiscal stimulation that you hadn't seen. But on balance, you know, you go back when I started investing in the mid-50s, you basically had an ability to watch the tape and try to take advantage of the market. In the late 1960s, you saw a lot of day traders doing the same thing. But at that time, the commissions were fixed by and large. And that did not change until May of 1975 when the commission structures changed. But coming out of that economic challenge of the early, late 1960s and early 70s, the banks decided, hey, you know what? We can't buy these cyclicals. We can't do conglomerates. The conglomerate era ended, I think, when Steinberg went after the chemical bank. And basically, they bought narrowly defined companies that had growth rates. I remember the analysts that I was dealing with that were competitors, but also friends. They would make projections out 20, 30 years and have a growth, and they called them the Nifty 50. Then in the 1983, 4, 5, 6, you had Leland O'Brien, Rubenstein come along and say, listen, the market goes down 10%, we're going to protect you, we're going to take you out. And they did the puts, and that resulted in everybody going to the exit. Then in 1989, you had the same dynamic with regards to the end of the market where Drexel was buying companies on leverage. And then 1999, you know, the stories that circulated that time, the individual that was going to Kathmandu to try to climb the mountain stopped at one of the locations. And somebody that was serving him said to him, what am I going to do with my Cisco stocks? And, you know, Lou Rukeyser, as much as I admired him, would have a conference out in Las Vegas. He'd invite whatever the capacity was. They paid $29 for 3 days. And so doctors were working on operations and watching their tape. And then in 2007, '08, '09, you had what happened with the bank stocks and the leverage that they use. And you watched Bear Stearns on a Monday trading at 90, and the next Monday it was bankrupt. So the different flavors, Caleb, but some of the dynamics of these excesses take hold. So nothing surprised me. However, I must admit that taking in a large number of individuals into the market, however, without guardrails, that disturbed me. I had an individual that I met at a Warren Buffett annual meeting. He wrote to me and said his cousin just committed suicide because he got a note at night that he owed like X dollars of on margin call. And he was like 21 years old. And he just said, I can't handle this. So the notion of having unbounded rules and regulations were not good. The second part is that somewhere around, I'm going to cuff this, 15 years ago, the uptick rule was eliminated. So the ETFs can just short sell stocks. And so you had a lot of changes, but the market goes through these cycles, and that's where you are today.
Yeah, going back to what you said about the Federal Reserve and the government, you know, pouring trillions of dollars to sort of stem the losses, stem the tide here to get us from falling into a really deep recession that would have lasted quarters. Do you think they've overdone it? Do you think it's time to loosen some of that a little bit? Or do you think the Fed is doing what it needs to do and the capital markets have responded in kind?
The Federal Reserve wants to solve this notion of a slowdown, wants to get economic recovery, wants to contain inflation. The problem short term is about a year ago, March, April, you know, people would just run to the supermarkets and clear out Costco with regards to toilet paper, paper towels, and they hoarded them. They loaded up the pantry with things like meat, and there were shortages. And so they went out to buy freezers that would allow them to store this at home, and you started to develop shortages. Corporations did the following. They cut back on CapEx. They worked down inventories. They took down their lines of credit. You almost had another run on the money market accounts back at that time. And so the Fed did what they had to do. And now that you're asking an interesting question, now that companies, CEOs are telling their purchasing agents, double order, don't worry about liquidity. I've got that laid down because I've got lines of credit and so on. And so that's creating a surge in commodities. And at the same time that's occurring, China came back into the market in a roaring way to build up their massive accumulated supplies. And so you had all these bottlenecks. So I think the Fed is right that some of these surge in demand is temporary. However, wage push inflation is not. So every day you're seeing, because of the imprecise way that it was allocated and continues to be allocated, individuals are making more money by not working. And so companies are putting out premiums to bring in teammates. And as a result of that, that wage push inflation is proliferating. And I don't know how that ends. Independent of that, Janet Yellen the other day just said, hey, you know, maybe we got to stop putting more money into the system, not yet taking it out. But that's a signal. Now, how's the market going to react to that? Now, you got a 10-year bond at 150. And obviously, that supports a lot of speculation. There's a lot of pricing. And the question is, if inflation is at 2.5%, does that settle in? And when does it settle in at 4%? Now, then you take the Fed. The budget that the president proposed for the fiscal year at the government that starts, I believe, on October 1st, is about $6 trillion out of pocket, and we're taking in about $4 trillion. And so that is overlaying a significant amount of stimulus when it may not be needed. But more importantly, it's not as precise as it could be. It's not precision economics.
I want you to take us, if you don't mind, through your basic process of how you spot opportunities in companies. What are the key things you're always looking for inside your investment firm and that you've always sort of been tried and true? What are those basics that investors can learn from?
Well, because we follow industries for 20, 30 years, let's take an example, companion pets. Dogs and cats. There's like 90 million dogs and 94 million cats in the U.S. and the population around the world. Companion pets became very interesting. But you go back. I started following Hartz Mountain when Leonard Stern was running the company in the 70s. He went private, spun off that business, got into real estate. Then we picked up a company called Ralston Purina, which had various type of protein products for animals. They sold that business out to Nestle's. So we were thinking about companion pets, and then we picked up a company called Veterinary Centers of America, which went public. And we picked up other companies that went public, like Heska, and so on. So we became sensitized to this area. So we have individuals that have identified companies. And in a world in which you have digital and where you have home delivery, companies like Chewy, companies like Zoetis, companies that show up. So our team has done that kind of work. Another example is the aging of the American population. If you listen to the demographics that what you're listening to on China, where they're going to a more than one child policy to two children and now more, you know that if the population is aging, if you want to ride a motorcycle at the age of 80, you may need a new hip, you may need a new knee. So we had determined that we would look at companies that did glasses, dental. And so we have a team that has been working on that area for an extended period of time. And then obviously, that's an example. But as a firm, until the Berlin Wall came down in November of 1989 and Tiananmen Square in China occurred, we really didn't invest globally, but we went around the world to look at companies. So then we decided to cover companies globally. So now we step back with the market where they are. I am going to cuff a number. I think the equity cap of all of the publicly traded stocks on a global basis, let's call it $110 trillion. Of that amount, the United States is about 40%, which means that the marketplace is important in the United States and is obviously is fundamental. But how do we participate in the global marketplace and what happens with the administration doing certain things? Then you step back and you see another trend, and that is the whole world and the notion of climate change. How do we deal with the environment? And then on top of that, they deal with social issues and they deal with governance issues. So ESG has become a fairly interesting dynamic that we have to deal with, and appropriately so. So, for example, in the 1960s, when I was at Columbia Business School, we basically had a movie called The Graduate. At that time, The Graduate said, there's a great future in plastics. And so now there's a great future in recycling plastic, changing, so aluminum cans. So we have an analyst, she's done a great job covering recyclability of aluminum cans and the adaptability of that and substituting that for certain types of plastics. So that's how we find ideas and how we stick with them.
We have a lot of individual investors, Mario, who listen to this and they come to Investopedia to get educated about investing, to get started in their investing careers. How would you simply counsel someone who's just beginning their investing career?
If you have one less Starbucks at $6 a day, if you're young at 20, and don't consume it, one less Truly or White Club beer, you know, put that money one day a week into an account and then step back since you're comfortable with numbers. Look at what happens if you earn 2, 4, 6, 8, 10% over the next 40 years and how much will that accumulate to? And obviously, watch your tax structure, figure out how you put it up into a tax-deferred account, part A. Part B, there's nothing wrong with trading. There's nothing wrong with speculation, but look at it from the point of view of investing. How do you find a business? How do you get to do the research other than listening to your program? And how do you get to think about companies that provide a value-added service and that will be around for the next 30 or 40 years or 20 years? And what price do you pay? What is the price that you should pay? And how much risk can you tolerate when you have times like 09 and 87? And, you know, I can go back from 17, whatever the various challenges were, 1893, 1907, 1919. And that's the notion of having flexibility in your portfolio to take advantage of or be prepared to take some unusual allocations of capital.
What's the biggest mistake you made as an investor and what did you learn from it?
Well, I make so many mistakes, but I can give you a couple of them. Once as an auto analyst, I went out to California and I visited with Earl Scheib, is located somewhere in Wilshire. You paint any car, any color, 1995. Interesting business model. And the real estate on Wilshire was worth more than the entire company. But it took 30 years to get a return. You know, so if we doubled our money from $5 to $10 a share when it was taken over, and that's not the right math, but numbers. But the idea was there. We didn't make any money over an extended period of time. Secondly, I tend to think about what price do I want to pay for stock. When Netflix changed over their business model and went to a recovering model of, and then raised price for the first time, the stock dropped, and I was a dollar away from buying a lot of it. And it was right in my sweet spot.
Who was your greatest teacher as an investor? Who really taught you the most, and what were your key takeaways?
Well, I had at Fordham, a guy was going for his PhD at Columbia. His name was Eamon Kelly. He told me about a lot about money and banking. And then what happened is that he wound up, you know, doing a variety of things. And one of the things he did is he became the CEO of president of Tulane. And so, you know, I actually had him on the board of our public company for a while. So learning about the Fed and those dynamics. But the real issue for me, having been an accounting major and having taken finance and global finance and learned a little bit about some other aspects of business, Caleb, I walked into Columbia and there was a guy teaching me, Roger Murray. He was the successor to Graham and Dodd at Columbia teaching value investing. So when I took that course, it was clear to me that that's what I wanted to do. I knew I wanted to be in the investment business. I didn't know what facet of it. And so as a result of that, that's where the concept of a microscope to companies came from.
A generous individual, not only with your philanthropy, but with your education and helping other investors learn along the way and really taught generations of investors. We really appreciate you joining the Express. Mario Gabelli, thanks so much for your time.
And thank you for those generous comments, and I hope to earn them in the future as well as in the current time. Thanks, Caleb.
It's terminology time. Time for us to get smart with the investing term the educated investor needs to know this week. This week's term comes to us from Frank in New York, New York. What's up, neighbor? Frank suggests the price-to-sales ratio as this week's term, and we like that suggestion given how highly valued some stocks are right now given their sales and their future sales projections. The price-to-sales ratio is a valuation ratio that compares a company's stock price to its revenues. It's an indicator of the value that financial markets have placed on each dollar of a company's sales or returns. The price-to-sales ratio is calculated by dividing the stock price by the underlying company's sales per share. A low ratio could imply the stock is undervalued, while a ratio that is higher than average could indicate that a stock is overvalued. Frank, you got me curious about U.S. companies with the highest price-to-sales ratio, so I ran a little stock screener to see which large-cap S&P 500 stocks have a price-to-sales ratio over 100, and here are a few that came up. Snowflake, the cloud computing software company, Liberty Broadband, the offshoot of Liberty Media, and Cruise Lines, Royal Caribbean, and Norwegian Cruise Lines. The price-to-sales ratio for the S&P 500 itself stands at 3.086. That's an all-time high, and it's up 36% in the past year.
Good suggestion, Frank. You'll be getting a pair of the fiendishly handsome Investopedia socks for your suggestion. Sport those on your next trip to Yankee Stadium or Citi Field and send us a picture with you wearing them. We'll let the country of El Salvador take us out this week, and I don't mean for pupusas and a cold cerveza suprema, although that would be nice. The Central American country, with a population of 6.5 million people and a GDP of $27 billion, voted last week to accept Bitcoin as legal tender. That means it must be accepted by firms when offered as a payment for goods and services. Tax contributions can also be paid in Bitcoin, with the Bitcoin dollar exchange rate set by the market. Keep in mind, El Salvador's regional currency is the U.S. dollar. Here's Ernesto Castro, the president of the Legislative Assembly of El Salvador, announcing the results of last week's vote.
Se aprueba la ley en términos generales.
Well, we'll see you on Bitcoin Beach on the west coast of that beautiful little country. That's right. El Zonte, a little surfing village in southern El Salvador, has been using Bitcoin for over a year in its local economy. And hodlers have been flocking there for big waves and the ability to pay in crypto. Well, if you can't make it there, we'll meet you right back here next week on the Investopedia Express. Buena suerte, mis amigos. Nos vemos pronto.
Saludemos a calle orgullosos, seguimos suyos, ponemos.